Hello, everybody. This is Rob Fournette with the podcast Hodgepot, and I have a return guest on my podcast, and it's J.V. Hilliard, has been gracious enough to join me. He is the author of the Warminster series. I am looking forward to having him back on. And J.V., we last spoke last July, so time has flown by. I follow you on social media. You have been extremely, extremely busy. So welcome back.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to return, and I'm glad to be able to not only speak to you, but all of your listeners and your followers. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Absolutely. So I am currently reading your first book, The Last Keeper, and it's an amazing book. And the reason why I say that is like the intricate details of every word that you put into this book that I've read is amazing. So how do you do that? Like, it's amazing. The detail is extraordinary.
Well, in part, it's trained. I'm both a reader and a writer. Mm-hmm. And, you read enough stuff, you see patterns. And if you're a good communicator, you're able to take those patterns and unweave it and weave it back in your own words. And for me, I've been writing since I was very young, and professionally prior to my transition to being an author, I wrote every day. Now, it was nonfiction. And so there were things that I needed to do to pick up on my storytelling stuff. But for me, I think translating the verbal communication I do on a day-to-day basis into the written is a completely different medium. It's the same way you see a different medium when you watch a movie or you're tuning in on TV. They deliver things in a different way than you would see in a comic book, which has very little space. You've got, 8 frames a page, and that's about it. And you've got limited words you could put in there. And here I am with this epic fantasy where I'm writing 150,000 word, 450 page novels, as part of it. It's just a different medium, and I think part of it is, the training I've done over the years by accident and on purpose. But I've also been a pretty good storyteller since I was young, a wee lad when I was playing Dungeons and Dragons and, was volunteered as our first dungeon master. And, as part of that geekdom, you have to be a good storyteller to keep everybody engaged. And that's what I did.
Absolutely. So, I've noticed since we last spoke, and you probably had these awards, but you've gotten some pretty big awards here in the last, since I just went on your website, the Amazon bestseller, the Literary Titan Book Award, and the Authors Zone December 2023 first place winner. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. I mean, I was humbled by all of them. Amazon bestseller stuff is a great first step for any author to reach that. And, and for me, I was ecstatic, over the moon. It was a lifelong goal. And, I'm glad that I got there. And I think that'll also help the other books in the series get there as well. And then, the Literary Titan one, was one I got a couple of years ago when I just started out and was just The Last Keeper. And, and they gave me a 5-star rating and I got entered into their finals. And, and then this TAS award, I got to tell you, it was a lot of fun. The idea behind it started, like 15 years ago, and the woman who runs the program, is overwhelmed with entries, and she gets entries from around the world, just not here in the States. And to be number one in my category was, like I said before, a humbling experience. And I hope that speaks well for not just book one for the Amazon stuff, but that was, I won for series, and then my series isn't even complete yet. So I'll take that one to the bank. That was a pretty unique award, and I enjoyed picking it up, earlier this year, or last year, I guess.
Absolutely. So when we last spoke last July, you were on your way to Raleigh, North Carolina for a convention. And have you been on the road a lot since July? Because have you seen an increase in popularity for your series?
Yeah, it's been amazing. I mean, Raleigh was an incredible experience. For those who have never been to a Comic-Con or what I went to, which was a Galaxy-Con, those cons are so well attended. And I had about 60,000 people come by my booth in Raleigh last summer, and I sold out by Saturday. Saturday
60,000 people? Wow.
Yeah, so I had literally one... I had a day and a half where I was just helping other authors sell their books, and it was great. It was an excellent experience. And that's a small one. You go to the San Diego Comic-Con or New York Comic-Con, you're looking at hundreds of thousands of people. So I was honored to be part of that and to speak at it as well. But also, on the back end of it, you know, that was I timed the release of book three right with, I was announcing it at the con. And so I think that helped push all the books through. People were clamoring to get them. And, you know, book four comes out here in April, although I'm going to be at my first con this year starts next weekend in Richmond. They'll run all the way through right before the holidays again. And there's a bit of a break, between the holidays and, this time of year. So right as you get into that spring breaky kind of, you know, then all of a sudden nerds and geeks come out of the corners and you crawl out of their homes and they start looking for geeky things to do. And GalaxyCon is one of those. So proud to be part of that community.
So I'm currently reading book number one in the series, and I was wondering, can I read an excerpt out of this book here? Because there's a couple of lines here that when I was reading it, I found to be very descriptive, and I was talking about your writing earlier. Do you mind if I read like a few paragraphs?
Sure, fire away.
All right, so this is page 78 of The Last Keeper, and Damius took the note from the man, and before either Damus or Casper had time to ask another question, he withdrew from the cloister and left them alone again. The note was written on a stamped, faded scroll. The seal was nearly white, a similar color to Damus's eyes, and depicted an open tome. "That's the seal of the Great Keeper," Casper gasped. His voice simultaneously awestruck and impressed. "Damus, what have you done? The Great Keeper doesn't send letters to just anyone, especially in her own hand." I found that to be, like when I was talking about earlier, very descriptive, and I could actually see it in my brain when I was reading it. I think that was just a little excerpt of the book, but I found that to be what I was explaining earlier.
Oh, well, you know, that's a really important scene. I'm not going to ruin it for you if you haven't gotten past that part yet, but, you know, but Damus is the main character for those mm-hmm. who haven't read the series, and, you know, he's about to be called in front of what I would describe as their Pope. The Great Keeper is the one that oversees their entire religious structure, and he's a low keeper. We have basically an initiate, somebody that's been brought in to learn their craft and their religion, and it's because of his powers that he's called in front of her, and she discovers these powers, and he has a chance to, you know, I don't want to spoiler alerts here, but he has a chance to go see some. And no low keeper would ever be summoned to see the Great Keeper for any other reason. And so his best friend and cloister mate, Casper, is like, "What did you do? You have to be in trouble. I don't know what's going on." And you'll find out very shortly from that, a couple of pages in, that he is in trouble. And so I'll give you that much.
All right.
Keep you going, but I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, and when you say the low keeper, is that like at the bottom of the totem pole?
Low keeper is, like I said, it's sort of the initiate level. So imagine you coming into college and you're a freshman, right? and you have to grow to be a senior. In this case, there's a variety of sects within the Divine Protectorate of Eirud, which is the name of his religion. And so, you know, if I said Pope before as the Great Keeper, then you have a rung of cardinals underneath the Pope, which in this case would be the High Keepers. And then you've got prefects, which are sort of the teachers and the professors and others that have these divine powers that are teaching these oracles mm-hmm. and these prophets how to use their ability. And then below them is another rung, which are low keepers. They are really, truly the students, and they're learning to harness these powers that are God-touched. You know, they each have a way of being able to predict the future or see things that they shouldn't see. And, you know, and they each do it in a different way. And in Damus's case, he sees the future in his dreams, which often in book one in particular happen to be nightmares. So
yeah,
you see some big, bad, evil things coming down the pike.
Yeah. Exactly. And when I'm reading the book here, so like if you go back to book number one, I know you have book number four coming out in April, but so like when you were writing the book here in book number one, were you able to have days where you wrote a lot, and then other days where you just maybe had writer's block? I think I asked you that last time, but what was that like there? If you can elaborate on that.
Yeah, you know, I'm a planner at my core, so I knew that the hard part for me in writing the book was putting together the outline for it. You know, you want to have a good story, you want it to have inflection points where you see the characters falter and they come back, and there's you know, points of redemption and the struggle that you kind of build into it so that people can identify with varying points of it. Right. And I think that for me, was the hard part, was getting the outline. Once I got the outline, I knew the direction I was writing. It became a lot easier for me. And I think that allows me to abate writer's block because the hard work's already done. You know, for me, then it's just a matter of explaining what's going on in certain scenes. And I have a tendency to write backwards to forwards anyway. So I'll write the ending of a story and then go back and write the beginning and then fill in the spots in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not even going to say that's unique. I know that there's a lot of authors out there that have different practices for what they need to do. And, you know, for me, I find, you know, I find the outlining piece the hardest part about it, but it's the most rewarding. Cause once you see the story flesh out in front of you, you can add meat to the bone all day long if you need to. And there are other writers out there that are different, right? They are, I'm a planner or a plotter. They're called pantsers, you know, and they write by the seat of their pants, you know, Stephen King being the most popular of a pantser, where they just sit down, they get an idea, they start writing. I would never do that. That's when I would get writer's block. I would freeze up the moment you told me to just start writing a story. I couldn't do it. I would need to know, well, where's it going and how does it end? And you know, what are the characters like and all that? And Stephen or others like him just plow away. And then they hit writer's block when they can't figure out how this thing ties up in the end. And so they have a different type of issue than I do, you know, where mine is really the writer's block in the beginning. Theirs is how does this story end? You know, so I, you know, for me, I've always been a planner and it's something that I think is important, especially when you're writing novels like I do in the epic fantasy. I mean, there's just too many details not to be ready for it. You don't want to leave something out or you don't want to screw something up. And, you know, so for me, that's the way my writing process has been. And I'll tell you what, too, you know, for those that have experienced writer's block, there are ways around that. Like I literally, I'll talk to another creative. They don't have to be another writer. You know, it could be someone you play Dungeons and Dragons with. It could be a painter. It could be a sculptor. It could be a potter, just somebody that makes something, you know, out of their own imagination. And they're going to get it and they're going to help you through it. And if you talk them through and ask them for the, even if it's not the final product that you decide on, it will get those creative juices flowing. Or, you know, I have a tendency to listen to music. Like I'll have different play charts and tracks for different things. You know, so if I'm writing a battle scene, I might be listening to Metallica or Five Finger Death Punch. If I'm writing a romance scene, it'll be something different, you know, but you know, that kind of, it kind of gets you in the mood for it. Right. Or a song has inspired a character or a song has inspired a scene or the atmosphere in a scene because you saw it, you know, like, Coming in the Air Tonight by Phil Collins.
Oh my goodness.
Inspired the fog, just the fog scene in the pre-battle scene for my, my last novel. It was like, it's one of those things where you just, you know, the song has nothing to do with it, but in the end, I just see this dark, like after midnight darkness,
yeah.
You know, but this fog sitting there and it's just this chill night and both armies are silent because they know it's going to come. And then it does, you know, and it's and that kind of thing, you just hear that or Salisbury Hill from Peter Gabriel, where like really kind of pushes like the scene, which you're not at yet. There's a scene very, very close to where you are that's inspired by Peter Gabriel where, you know, Damis gets a visit by somebody who comes and takes him home and it's right out of Salisbury Hill. And it was like, has nothing to do with Salisbury Hill, but it has everything to do with my novel, you know, and that kind of stuff helps you too. Cause you visualize things and you don't even know you're doing it. And so for a guy like me, I either dictate something on my phone so I don't lose it, or I carry around a pad, make sure that I don't lose those items. And then they all go into this crazy, you know, Joe script that no one else could read and decipher except for me. And then I look at it and I'll remember to do it and drop it in at the right place.
I got a little new feature in my podcast. We're going to talk about music a little bit later. So I'm looking forward to that. But
oh, sure.
I am a consumer. I'm a creator of a podcast, but I am not a musician. I'm not a writer. So I'm a consumer. So when I read books, I have to sometimes write down notes just to draw my memory when I'm doing. So I'm doing it with your book here, book number one. Talk about book number four. It's coming out in April. So talk about the release and what can your fans and my listeners expect from your fourth book in the series?
Yeah. So the fourth book is called Echoes of Ghostwood and it's a return to the beginning. You know, when you see Damis in its first scene, he's lost in a petrified forest surrounded by fog. And that is an area called Ashen Hollows or referred to by the locals as Ghostwood. And at the end, the echoes of Ghostwood and what happened there return for everybody. So it's like, you know, the circle comes full and you see it end right where it began. And I think that was important for a variety of reasons. It's sort of like that old hero's journey that you see in Harry Potter or Star Wars or the Iliad and the Odyssey. I mean, you just see that same kind of return, you know, and I thought that was important. But also, I'll say this, if you're a fan of action fantasy, this is going to be, it is one long battle. You know, it is the culmination of an entire series of 500,000 words that come together finally in this final book where you see everything flesh itself out. You're not going to be happy with every ending. I'm going to tell you that right now. Wow. I'm not going to spoil anything, but okay. You know, let's just so say that there's a dark fantasy here where the good guys don't always win. And there's a bit of a spin that will get fans that, you know, of Game of Thrones and other things that are like that, where the good guys don't always win there either. They're going to like this, but it is, you range from battle scene to battle scene. And those battle scenes could be epic, large Tolkien-esque battle scenes where you've got massive armies on the battlefield. You'll see that in this. And you also see individual battles, whether it's a duel or a mind battle or a spell battle. There's a lot of stuff going on here. And then, of course, it sets up for series number 2, which I'll get to in 2025. So, wow. You know, I'm really looking forward to getting the readers on this one, because when I was writing, you were talking before, like how you write, sometimes you can't stop. You just have to write it because it's coming out of you. And you're just like, I got to go. And you don't want to stop because you're going to lose the momentum that you have. And then all of a sudden you look up and it's 3 a.m. and you're like, how did I get here? You know what I mean? But like you just, your head's down and you're clicking away. You know, and that's what made writing Echoes so much fun. And there's parts where, you know, it's hard. I know I'm going to get stuff from readers about certain characters not making it the full way through, but it makes for a better story. I'm just warning you, you'll be mad, but when you calm down, you'll say, you know what, this is a better ending.
I got a lot of catching up to do, so I'm going to get you on after I read the fourth book, because I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to get you on. I got a lot of catching up to do. So when you look back at your writing here, do you ever like look back and say, wow, I can't believe I've done this fourth book and I'm going to start a second series? I'm always fascinated by authors, singers who go back and look at the body of their work. And then do they have like a moment where they go, wow, I can't believe I put this together?
Well, yeah, you know, it's humbling. And you've created something that will be out there forever, long after I'm gone, hopefully. You know, and people will love to, you know, continue to read it. And I've been blessed with the opportunity to license the intellectual property into a video game. I'm also in the process of working with a publishing house to put together a graphic novel adaptation for this. So it is finding its way into different forms of media, which I think is important, not only for me to gather additional readership, but also for it to be seen in other places. Not everybody's a reader. Right. There are people that just love to go see movies and will never pick up a book, and vice versa. Like, how many times have you read a book and then seen the movie and being like, oh, this book is so much better than the movie. Yeah. And it's because the movie's in your head. Like, you've already seen it. Like, you're creating that scene, you know, you're in your head. That's exactly the way it's supposed to be. And then you go and you see a character that's mm-hmm. I'll give you a perfect example of one. Jack Reacher, Lee Child's Jack Reacher. Love the books. Right. And all of a sudden they march out 5'6" Tom Cruise. How is that Jack Reacher? It's just impossible. A guy that's supposed to be 6'8". You know what I mean? And you're driving in the new Jack Reacher, the Amazon Jack Reacher, they cast a guy. You're like, now that's Jack Reacher. Yeah. That's exactly what you saw. So sometimes it's jarring when that happens, you know, but for me, you know, I've taken a back seat and I've let the creative processes and juices from the video games, like the coders that are doing their work there, do their stuff because they're good at what they do too. You know, or the same thing with the graphic novelist. They're going to take my chapter, which might be 4,000 or 5,000 words long, and they're going to boil it down into 8 frames, maybe with a total of 50 words on 2 pages. And it's going to have that same effect. And their readership loves it. There are people, those, you know, graphic novels are adult comic books, mm-hmm. right? They're going to take you through the story. And I think that will then, that allows me to broaden my readership. Now people that read the graphic novel might go out and buy this, or the people that are playing a video game might want to see it on the big screen one day, you know, that kind of stuff. And so I think the more media that it gets into, the better it is for the story and its longevity. And that's when I said the word humbling before, it really is. You just, you know, you look up and you say to yourself, man, I don't know how I got here, but I got here.
Yeah. And you're still good. Plugging away, and then you're really, you know, getting into that second series. And you mentioned Jack Reacher. I am a huge fan of the Amazon series. That series is phenomenal. I can't wait till season 3 comes out next year. I wish they had 15 episodes. I think they had 8 or 9. So it was a tremendous season 2. So I always like to talk about like where people are. You live in Pittsburgh. So let's talk about Pittsburgh a little bit. Just get off on a tangent here. So I went to Pittsburgh many years ago. I had to do a convention when I worked in the food business. And there is a view from up top the hill looking down at Pittsburgh, which is tremendous. Can you talk about that? Because what's Pittsburgh like?
Oh, yeah. What you're describing is Mount Washington. There is a mountain on the south side of the city that oversees the entirety of the point. And you get to see all three rivers, the confluence at the point, the majority of the city as it bleeds up from the rivers into an area of the city called Oakland, where the schools are, where most of the colleges and universities are. And then you also get a vantage point of, you know, the south side of Pittsburgh, which was its own city at one time called Birmingham. And when they merged into what was at the time Pittsburgh, which is why we have an H at the end, like Edinburgh. But because there's so many Germans that settled here, it became Pittsburgh. And they never dropped the H because it was really Scottish and William Pitt, right? So you got, and then you see the North Shore where all the stadiums are for the games and stuff. And it's really, it's like a small Chicago, right? You get a lot of neighborhoody areas. In certain areas of the city, you can look 15 city blocks and see 5 different types of churches and stuff, just because of the pockets of immigrants that settled here during the industrial era. But the city's been modernized. I mean, I know that for those that are outside that don't get to travel in, still think of steel and coal and fire and soot. But at the end of the day, that's all gone. You know, now it's robotics, it's healthcare, it's a lot of genetics and biotechnology and things like that. The city has really changed since I was a wee lad. You know, when my dad was here and living, he worked in a mill. You know, my grandfather before him worked in a mine. You know, and those opportunities just don't exist here anymore. What's really here is robotics, advanced manufacturing, and a lot of biotech and life science stuff. And so, you know, and that's a credit to Carnegie Mellon University, the University of Pittsburgh, you know, and some of the other colleges in the area here. And so the city's remade itself. It's about as clean as you can get. It's as safe as you can get. It's always either the most livable city rated every year or in the top 3 for it, you know, and it's one of those places where it's a hidden gem. You get all the benefits of a big city without the crime and pollution and all the bad stuff that comes along with that sometimes. So, you know, it's something that, you know, it's underrated. And I think folks here like it that way.
Yeah. I remember the view. We were up when I was there. We went up for lunch. There was a restaurant up there at the top, and there was a vantage point where you could look down and you could just hear the hum of the city. It was a nice, beautiful, sunny day. It's one of the most spectacular views you'll ever see. You see the whole city of Pittsburgh with the river. Awesome, awesome scene. And I'm wearing my Pittsburgh Pirates hat tonight in honor of JV being on my podcast. So I wanted to make sure I represent Pittsburgh on the podcast. So I appreciate him coming on. So I always liked, I'm going to start a new thing on my podcast. What is the last song you listened to on your playlist? And you had mentioned some groups earlier. So what was the last song you listened to on your playlist?
You know, I'm going to show you right now. It is.
I love this.
Well, yeah, let me see if I can do it. It is Heathens by 21 Pilots. And I don't know if that's going to show up on your screen or not. But, you know, ultimately, I have a pretty eclectic palette when it comes to music. I listen to everything except for country. I can do some of the poppy country, but for the most part, the twangy country, I just, it doesn't sit with me. Or that bluegrass stuff. It's just not my style. But if you went on here, you would find gangster rap to heavy metal to classical. And I don't know if that's my left brain, right brain thing. I have no idea what it is, but I'm not a one or two genre guy. Like, you'll find stuff in there that's all over the map just because that's who I am. So that one, the one I just listened to last was 21 Pilots.
Interesting, because the last one I listened to was Texarkana by REM off their Out of Time album from 1991. So that's the one where Michael Stipe did not lead sing on that song. So that's a great song. I always find it fascinating. You had mentioned Phil Collins earlier and Peter Gabriel. You had inspirations for your book. pretty incredible. So I am that same way. I listen to classical, and sometimes if I'm not in a heavy metal mood, I'll listen to 80s pop or 80s light rock or 70s or 60s. So it's, again, your book comes out in April, right, JV? And where can we find your your information for, where can we find you on the web?
Yeah, sure. So the book launches on pretty much every platform you can imagine. So if you like reading ebooks, you'll find it on the 20 different platforms that are available there. If you want to get a hardback or a paperback in your hand, you can get it from dragonmoonpress.com, which is my publishing house, or you can find it on, if you're an Amazon shopper, you go to Amazon and find it there. If you like getting your stuff through audiobooks, you can find it on Audible or any of those. I use iTunes, you know, for that kind of stuff, and download it there as well. I'm easy to find, you know, jvhilliard.com.
Very easy.
HILLIARD.com. And my socials are at JV Hilliard Books or just JV Hilliard. And if it's just JV Hilliard, just look for the one that's the author. And that'll be me. You can't miss it because it usually has my book covers as my I'm not a very photogenic guy. So the book covers sell more than my face. So, and but I am, about as self-aware as you can get. And so I'd rather have those book covers, they're award-winning book covers, as opposed to my 4 out of 10 mug here that no one wants to see anyway.
I'm sure. Well, I'll tell you what, when you're at your conventions, I'm sure people know who you are and all that good stuff. It's just one other thing about Pittsburgh before I let you go. Is there a place up there called Permane Brothers?
There is. So Permane Brothers is our more regionally famous. It's now prepped into other cities. It's a sandwich. The Permane Brothers started a sandwich back when we had a lot of steel mills. And the concept was these guys only had a 30-minute work lunch. And so they would leave the mills and go across the street onto, you know, into a bar or a restaurant. And they didn't have time to eat a full meal. So the Permane Brothers decided they were going to help them out. And they took a traditional sandwich, put coleslaw on the sandwich. This is like a vinegar-based coleslaw. Yeah. It's very Eastern European, very German. If you eat Klaus, you'll know what I'm talking about. And then they put fries on it. So they put your meal, your coleslaw, your fries, and your meat all in a sandwich, smashed it together in Mancini's bread, and served it, and they just ate it at the same time. And that's where it really came from. But over the years, it became so popular and such a staple of the city that people come in just to try it. It's like our version of Skyline Chili in Cincinnati, or, you know, you go to Chicago for deep dish, or Detroit mm-hmm. for their, you know, the Detroit pie. Everybody has something different in different places. And Permane sandwiches are legendary here and have now crept into other places. And even those expatriates that live in other places order them, and they can get them delivered on dry ice and stuff like that, that have their Permanes. But it's a staple of the city. It might, to some people, they're like, oh my God, I can't believe you eat that. And then you try it and you're like, oh, that wasn't all that bad. You know what I mean? It might not be healthy.
It is phenomenal.
Yeah, but it's some good stuff, man. It's really good stuff. And I would encourage everybody to try it at least once.
Yeah, try it once. I lived in Fort Lauderdale from 95 to 97. They opened up one in Fort Lauderdale, and I ate there a couple of times. Absolutely phenomenal. So, JV, I know you're always busy on your I appreciate your time that you've carved out for my podcast. I think you got another one in a little bit, but I want to really appreciate and thank you for coming on my podcast. And when I'm done with the fourth book, I'm going to have you back on again, because I want to give you you might have to test me on that, so I'm looking forward to it.
No, I'd be more than happy to do it, and when number 4 hits the presses, I'll get you a copy and let me know what you think, and happy to come on again anytime. It's always a pleasure.
All right, I know you're busy. So